I was eating my soup, and I finished that. I was eating the turkey, and the next thing was pumpkin pie. I was really tired. I had a full belly. I had been swimming all day with my sister. Our hotel was 10 feet away from a pool and 30 feet away from the ocean. I was tired. If only I could close my eyes for just a second. Oh. You know what happened. I fell asleep. My dad had to carry me home. The next thing I knew, I woke up in my bed at the hotel. I thought, how did I get here? I was at the restaurant. My mom and sister come in. I ask them, weren't we at the restaurant about to eat pie? They brought me home some pie in a to-go box. They're a nice family. The end.
I wasn't that brave when I was your age to set up in front of people and tell a story. That was great. So his sister, his nice family that he spoke of, is some of them are sitting over there, and Megan is 14 years old and in ninth grade. She's just a half inch taller than her brother, and she's always reading books. Megan loves music, both singing and playing piano, and her piano instructor happens to be this guy. So Megan, come on up.
Hi everybody, I'm Megan, and in 2011, my family and I took a vacation to Belize, which is the same vacation you heard my brother mention, and it was super cool. It was tropical and warm, which was the best part. Our hotel was, in a word, perfect. It was super close to the ocean and the pool, like my brother mentioned, and it also had hammocks on the beach and lots of sand for sandcastles. And it also had a breakfast shack that had orange juice and toast every morning. It was awesome. On the second to last day that we were in Belize, my dad decided to rent a bicycle to go find some iguanas. My brother and I had been swimming in the pool for about an hour when Dad came back and he said he had found two iguanas. So we wrapped ourselves in towels, put on our shoes, and walked down the road, dripping water all the way. On the left side of the road was a large white concrete wall about 4 to 5 feet high. And on the right side of the road was tropical vegetation with some stone walls jutting out to separate people's property. We found the first iguana on one of the stone walls. It was beautiful. The sun was hitting its body and it complemented its green skin, and it was absolutely amazing. We immediately took pictures and just watched it to see if it would do anything cool. It didn't end up doing anything cool, but it was still awesome. We continued down the road to look for that second elusive iguana. And I was determined that I was gonna find it first. The first time I realized I had missed something was when I heard my parents talking about something that had boggled their minds. And I immediately asked, what was it? And my mom explained that it was a local construction site across the street. But instead of using scaffolding, they used branches and sticks to hold up the various walls. I was intrigued. I decided that I would make a point to see it on the way back to the hotel. We found the second iguana, and it was just as cool as the first. It was probably 2 feet long and really awesome. We turned around and headed back to the hotel, and I remembered that I was going to look for the construction site. I saw it, and it was really cool. My 8-year-old curiosity was definitely satisfied. The walls looked like they could tip over because they only had little tiny branches holding them up. It was kind of mind-boggling. It looked like it would tip over in the slightest breath of wind. I was paying so much attention to the construction site that I wasn't looking where I was going. And the first time I realized something was wrong was when my dad stepped out into the middle of the road and said, "Megan, look at me. I need you to walk toward me, please." And we had had this conversation before we came to Belize that if mom and dad say to come to them, you need to come immediately because it's probably something that's harmful for you that you don't see, like maybe a pothole or a car coming. So I got a little bit panicked and I was like, okay, why? And I started walking toward dad while trying to twist my body so I could see what was behind me or in front of me. And I got about 3/4 of the way when I'd almost twisted my body enough that I could see it, and my dad said, "Megan, look at me. Walk toward me." I knew it was really bad then. I got almost to dad when I could see what had been 2 feet in front of me. It was big. It was black and red, and it had 8 hairy legs. It was a tarantula, 6 inches of horror. I freaked out. I screamed and ran to dad, and I climbed him like a ladder. I wanted to be as far away from the ground as I possibly could. I ended up having my hands wrapped around dad's neck and my feet wrapped around dad's waist. And he just walked calmly across the road, away from the tarantula, and he patiently waited 5 minutes for me to finally come down and stand quivering behind mom, who handed my 6-year-old little brother, Zach, the camera. "Here you go, go take pictures." He got about a foot away and was taking, "Wow, this is so cool. Oh, wow, we got some great close-ups." Dad and Zach were taking pictures of the tarantula when some native Belizean guys drove up in their golf cart, which is standard transportation in Belize. And they got out and they were like, "Oh, wow, this is so cool." And one of the Belizean guys offered, "Do you want me to hold it?" And Dad and Zach, "No, thank you. We do not want you to touch it." He still touched it anyway. And the spider was like, "Hey, come on. I'm just sitting here. Like, why did you have to touch me?" We went to the hotel pretty quickly after that, and I was very, very glad that it was our last night in Belize because I did not want to run into another tarantula again.
You guys are great storytellers. All right, so kid number one, kid number two now, mom. Sabrina and her husband Jim have lived in Soldotna for over 19 years. She's has 2 Alaskan grown kids, like you just heard stories from, and she's educated both of them at home for all of their years. Sabrina assists Jim, her husband, with bookkeeping for his airplane maintenance business, and she and the kids volunteer weekly at the Pregnancy Care Center in Kenai. She is a great mom, and I'm really happy that this whole family is sharing stories with us, so come on up, Sabrina.
Maybe next time my husband will share a story too. Well, I'm an ordinary wife and mother. You know, I cook meals, clean house, make sure that everything is put back in its place. I'm the kind of mom that says, "Not too much sugar. Always wear your bicycle helmet. Make sure you're in bed by 9. Yeah, that kind of mother. But every once in a while, a deep-seated fantasy comes to surface. I want to drive a racing motorcycle. I'm talking about a Kawasaki Ninja H2, the sleek kind with the big fat tires and the engine that whines as it goes around the corners, gripping and hugging the asphalt as it winds around. Yes, that kind of motorcycle mama. And of course, in this fantasy, I'm decked out in leather, and I have the perfect model hair toss when I take off my helmet. Well, we were talking about this at dinner one day, my alter ego fantasy, and the kids were staring at me in disbelief. They're overly cautious, and non-risk-taking mother was talking about being a road racing motorcycle mama. I don't even come in first when we do the go-karts down on the corner over here. I always take it slow because of that one slick spot where I might spin out. So the kids were having a hard time believing this. At this point, my husband leaned over and said, "Babe, maybe you'd better start with a moped first." And I was slightly offended and quite shocked. And then I realized, yeah, he's right. About a week later, I was doing what I like to do on Friday afternoons, and that is go garage sailing. And as I pulled up to a house, I noticed that there happened to be a moped sitting in the yard. Well, I've lived in Alaska for a long time, and I'd never seen a moped on the roads before. So I knew this was going to be a hot item, and it was going to sell quickly. So I jumped out of the car, walked over to the cashier, and as I was walking, I was trying to eye the price tag on the moped. I could see that the last number was a 5, but I couldn't tell if the first number was a 1. Was it $15? Or was it a 4? Was it $45? I was really hoping for the lesser of the two. So I asked the lady, how much is the moped? She replied, "Well, it's $5, but it needs some work. In fact, it needs somebody who's mechanically inclined to really buy it." So I thought to myself, "Well, I just happen to be married to a great mechanic. This couldn't be better. My dream is coming true." So I didn't want my enthusiasm to spill out and for the lady to see it and raise the price. So I just casually said, "I'll take it." Well, after several how-to YouTube videos, eBay parts, a few test runs, more YouTube videos, eBay parts, my husband had it in working condition. So we go out to the driveway. I strap on my bicycle helmet. I sit on the seat, put my hands on the handlebars in my seafoam green 1980s Spree moped, ready for a ride on the open road. Well, or at least a jaunt down the bumpy dirt road in our subdivision. So, as my hands are on the handlebars, I realize that the driving mechanism is pretty simple. In fact, it couldn't be more simple. Everything is operated with your hands. You twist the handlebars to make the bike go forward, and you squeeze the brakes to make it stop. There's no gears, no shifting, it's just accelerate or brake. But in my mind, I told myself that you twist forward to go forward and you turn down to slow down. Well, I soon found out that is not the case. So I ease out of the driveway, gaining speed and confidence as I go. And as I come to the end of the driveway, ready to turn onto our dirt road, I realize I'm going a bit too fast for my comfort level. So I turn the handlebars down, thinking I'm slowing down. I open the throttle, I speed across the road, hit the ditch on the other side, and crash! Well, as I emerge from the weeds, definitely bruised on my body, more bruised on my ego, I realized something, that I didn't really want to get back on the moped. In fact, I didn't get back on it for the rest of that summer. But more importantly, I realized that the chasm between reality and my fantasy world was really deep, and it's going to take a lot of practice to get to the other side.
Talented family. Thank you so much. Next up, we have a psycho. A psychology professor. Same thing. Actually, I think what relates in my heart is the love of travel. I've never met anyone who loves to travel as much as you, Paul. He just got back from Africa, and he told about his travels to a packed house last night, and so now you get to share another story about family tonight, and we're honored by your presence. You're quite the speaker. We're lucky that you could grace us.
I wouldn't go that far.
My father once said of his own mother that she would have made a good hooker, but she was too stupid to get paid for it. My grandmother, to say she was a force of nature would be to say that a hurricane is like a little rainstorm. She was a very, very interesting person. My dad had a really good perspective on things. My dad ran away when he was 16 years old. He disappeared for a couple of years with a 40-year-old woman. Joined the army in time for World War II. Didn't get out until 1946. And didn't graduate high school until he was over 30 years old. But my dad was a voracious reader. And he had a brother who was a very well-known psychologist. And my dad had a much, much better perspective on their mother than my uncle, the psychologist, did. We and my family would tell stories. My grandmother's name was Dorcas, and we would tell Dorcas stories. And we would take great delight in airing all of the dirty laundry of the family. And my dad would laugh at these. My uncle would get profoundly offended if any mention of her came up that wasn't flattering. Interestingly, my dad, who had a very honest perspective on who she was, we saw her every week. My uncle, who worshipped the ground she walked on and thought she was a saint, saw her maybe once every year or two, even though we lived the same distance away from her. My dad could take her as she was. She had a really almost a Cinderella story, but only the lousy parts. Her mother died in childbirth. Her father died when she was two. When she was 18, she eloped with, quote, the only man she ever loved. Unfortunately, she was married two more times. And she really had her heart broken. My dad's father, my dad never knew him. He vanished. He disappeared. My grandmother was in the hospital giving birth to their fourth child in 4 years, and he disappeared. He was never heard from again. No one knows whether he ran off with another woman, whether he was murdered. No one knows anything. He just vanished off the face of the earth. And she was left brokenhearted. When I was a kid, I laughed a lot at the stories about her. As an adult, I have a lot more compassion for her now. But these are the kinds of things that would happen. It was Thanksgiving. It was 1971, I think. My sister had just started dating this guy who has now been my brother-in-law for 40-odd years. And Steve was waiting to go into the bathroom. It was Thanksgiving Day. He had never met our family. This was the very first time he was at our house. He's waiting to go in the bathroom. My grandmother comes out of the bathroom. She sees him standing there. She looks around. They're all alone. She rips her blouse open, grabs her boobs, and says, 75 and still firm. Steve says he went in the bathroom and puked. I'm not sure I believe him, but what I do know to be fact is that he pulls my sister aside and says, "You won't believe what just happened," he tells her. And she says the last thing in the world he ever expected to hear, "You've got to tell my dad. He'll love this." And he looks at her and says, "Are you nuts? You want me to tell your father, who I just met for the first time today, that his mother just flashed me?" She ignores his protestations, grabs my dad and says, "You got to hear this, Dad." He tells her, and Dad just busts up. He's like, "That old hooker." Oh, but she could be tough. She could be tough. My Aunt Jane, I adored my Aunt Jane. My dad and his kid sister were really, really close. And Aunt Jane was widowed twice before she was 30 years old. And when her second husband, a very lovely man named Vaughn, when Vaughn died, when my grandmother found out that her daughter had been widowed for a second time, looked her in the eye and said, "You killed another one. This is all your fault." You know, my aunt decided right then and there that she was living in Michigan at the time, that she wanted to get as far away as she could without a passport. And she moved to Hawaii. And that was before statehood. My aunt moved to Hawaii. And she stayed in Hawaii the rest of her life. My dad and I, Aunt Jane was diagnosed with brain cancer. It was the summer of 1985. And Dad decided he was going to go spend a month with her in Hawaii. And he and I were talking. He said, "Why don't you come with me?" And I went with him for the first week. Dad and I were sitting there. It was a really early morning. It was a really beautiful morning. We're sitting there with Aunt Jane. And Aunt Jane and Dad and I were just chatting. And Dad looks at Aunt Jane. He says, "You know, Jane, you never thank me for your teeth." My dad looks at her and says, "What the hell are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, when I was in the war, I sent Mom half my paycheck every month. And when I got back, I asked her for the money because I needed to buy a car for the job I just got." She said, "Chuck, didn't I tell you? Jane was in an accident and she lost her teeth. So I gave her your money in order for her to get dentures." So my dad said, "Well, so Mom lent me some money and I bought the car and I paid her back." And Aunt Jane looks at Dad and says, "Chuck, these are my real teeth. I don't wear dentures." And they started to chuckle. "Isn't that just like Dork?" All of a sudden, Aunt Jane just busts up laughing. She just looks at my dad and says, "She lent you your own damn money. She didn't steal it once, she stole it twice." Oh, God, did we laugh. We laughed until it hurt. And my dad took great relish in telling this story for the next few months. By the time Aunt Jane died in 1985, my grandmother was still alive. She lived only a couple miles from my dad and my mom, and she hadn't known anyone in a few years, and she lived in a nursing home. She outlived her daughter by 5 years, but I noticed something really interesting. My dad never went and visited her again. By the time she died, there was no memorial service. There was no funeral. There was nothing. The final goodbye had occurred 5 years earlier.
He said it was going to be colorful. I didn't know how. I warned you. You know, so colorful is a theme, a family color. So Hetty Jo Huss has another colorful story. And she's a Chichaco, she says, only here 2.5 years, but you're an Alaskan and your family nonetheless. She loves theater and always wants a ticket, and Odie's storytelling helps fill the creativity for her. She mentors elementary kids in reading, writing, and poetry, and she loves polar bears.
I'm sure the Huss clan, my family, were the models for Grant Wood's famous painting, American Gothic. Like the people in the print, my relatives were so somber, somber. Their faces drooped to their chins, and they had no laughs within them. The poster child for this family was Uncle Myron. Now, Uncle Myron had a very much of a heyday in Milwaukee during the 30s. He was a successful manager of a utility company. But much more profitably, he ran his own gambling baseball pool. Once, though, my father, beer-drinking guy, had to pull Myron off a frozen porch because, he reeked with alcohol, and he was almost out. Finally, my dad got him into bed to sleep it off. Well, soon after that, Myron decided to go back up north to live with his mother. He was through with everything. He quit drinking. He quit his job. He quit everything, the raucous life that he had in Milwaukee. So he went back to Little Suamico, Wisconsin, about 20 miles north of Green Bay, and population about 200. So in the 50 years that he stayed on with Ma, he was the county board supervisor, and he never drank, never did that again, and he had season tickets to the Packers. But he also advocated AA, but the man never attended a meeting, and he certainly fell off the 12 steps. So his sisters were always around. They would leave their own families to come up north, and take care of Myron. So at Grandma's, they would come there and stay quite a while. Well, Myron, if he followed one of the sisters into the bathroom, he was surrounded with blue smoke. But he never acknowledged that she smoked. But every Christmas, there was a carton of cigarettes under the tree marked from Myron. Well, Grandma had a big old table in the kitchen and a wood-burning stove. And the oilcloth covered this big table. And each night at 10 o'clock was set a big spread of food. It was 10 o'clock lunch, but it didn't matter if it was midnight. After all the people ate, then Uncle Myron got to work on this table. And everybody had gone to bed, it was quiet, and he was doing his investments unbeknownst to us. All that socked away money from Milwaukee and the baseball pool he was putting to work. When he died, he left each sister $175,000. This was serious investing. So I can remember many good things about him when he wasn't a sour curmudgeon. Like when he had a free ticket to the Packers, he would take me with him. And he helped me learn patience while perch fishing in Green Bay. I think I sort of got it, even though I was pretty young, because the fish started coming into the boat. He said, more patience, got more fish. And I didn't know what patience was all about, but decades later I realized that Uncle Myron meant, be quiet.